and welcome to The Librarian on Authors on the Air. I am the librarian host, Tabitha Pope. This is a copyrighted and trademarked podcast owned solely by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC, on the web at authorsontheair.com. And our website's under construction right now, so if you go to authorsontheair.com, you won't see anything, but just give it about a week and we'll have it back up. Tonight, I'm very excited to have Shannon Lee Alexander, a young adult author with Entangled Tea, on the show tonight. And I'm very excited because I rarely get the young adult romance authors, and I'm super, super excited sometimes to get back in my element. And this is one of those nights where I can get back in my element. Shannon Lee Alexander is the author of the contemporary young adult novel Love and Other Unknown Variables and the newly released companion novel Life After Juliet. She is a wife and mother to two children and a terrier mutt named Harriet Potter, which is so cute. She is passionate about coffee, books, and cancer research. Shannon is a former English teacher and a forever Hufflepuff. Her writing is inspired by the memory of her dear friend who passed away after a 9-year battle with ovarian cancer. Watching her friend fight with bravery, grace, and hope changed Shannon's life. She hopes readers will get a sense of hope themselves when they read her novels. And you can find out more on her website, and you can follow her at all the social media links, including her Amazon author page, linked right on that page. And she is going to come live on the show right now. Welcome, Shannon.
Hi, Tabitha. Thank you for having me tonight.
I'm so excited because, as I mentioned just a second ago and to you, is you know, I rarely get the young adult authors on my show. I mean, if you know, every now and then I do. I think they're afraid to come on my show, because sometimes we have some really risque authors on here. But I think it's really important to, you know, to show that romance has so many different sides to it. And young adult is super, super, super popular, even with the adults. I mean, I will totally admit to having read tons of young adult romances. And I mean, if you think about the whole Twilight experience, how many adult women read that one? I mean, young adult romance, even, you know, and contemporary has just jumped up huge. And I love that. I love that because I think these kids, I are able to identify with the kids, the characters and everything. So as I was saying before, 2014 was the last year that I was an actual public librarian in the young adult section. And your book, your novel, Love and Other Unknown Variables, was one that I passed out quite a bit. It was brand new and it was still beautiful. Nobody, you know, beat it all up in the library. And I passed it out to a lot of kids because that was also the time when John Green's novels were so, you know, just so off the shelves. They were never there, you know, and they were talking about doing the movie and everything else. So yours was one I was like, well, if you think you like that, you should start this one, you know. And so so excited to talk to you because, you know, it was a very popular passed out book in my part of the library. So Life After Juliet's got to just be, I have one and I started it and I'm just ready for the rest of it. But I'm super excited to be able to share this with teen girls because I just, these are the, you know, you've got this, I don't want to call them issue novels because they're not really issue novels, but there's that element of, you know, there's other things going on that are conflicting, not just who wears the best makeup and who wears the best clothes and shoes and who carries the fancy purse. It's real stuff, you know? Yeah. So I love that about Rose. Now I'm going to let you talk because I got all my excitement out.
Okay. I laugh. Actually, I didn't realize I was a young adult romance writer necessarily when I started out writing. I just knew I had a story, and that Charlie from Love and Other Unknown Variables, mm-hmm. Charlie and Charlotte's story was it just kind of evolved over a lot of time, and love was definitely an element, but it was, writing romance wasn't my priority or my goal necessarily in writing it. So I didn't realize that I was a young adult romance writer until it was, because Entangled Publishing is a romance house, mm-hmm. that is kind of how I've ended up in that really unique and really amazing community of writers, actually. I was surprised. I was like, I wrote a romance. I didn't realize I did that. Okay. I'm a romance writer now. Sure. But I've been so delighted, and just, it's been so wonderful to be a part of the community, because they're just really supportive, really wonderful, writers, both the, you know, YA romance contemporary writers and the YA romance fantasy writers and sci-fi. They're a really great community to be a part of. And as a first-time author, it was so great to have all those people to kind of fall back on and ask questions and what am I doing? Because I had absolutely no idea. So yeah, I'm an accidental romance writer.
Romance author. Hey, that's a book on its own right there.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny that you say that,
though.
It
showed up at a party, and it was a romance party. Okay.
It's a party. It's always a party with romance authors, so there you go. But it's funny that you say that, because I don't think that that John Green probably would identify himself as a young adult romance author. And I know that Jay Asher doesn't, although he admits to it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
He admits that there's he doesn't say this is a young adult romance. He just says I belong in this class, you know? And I
right.
love that. Because,
there are romantic elements in my story.
Exactly. And the yes. romance is enough that it keeps the storyline going, you know? So it's the thing that is, even though there's all these things happening, and I don't know if you've read 13 Reasons Why, but same thing. There's other things going on. You know, so many different
yes.
things going on, but they still want to put that, you know, I mean, it's kind of like we had this thing going for a while. They wanted to do retail marketing in the library, you know, like retail mm-hmm. show them out and label them like romance and this, so that people would, but it was really hard to do in the teen section, because if you put a big heart sticker on it that said romance, there wasn't a boy in the world that was going to pick that book up.
Yes.
But if
yeah.
you said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is
right?
tricky. Because especially with Love and Other Unknown Variables, the main character is a guy, a math uh-huh. and science geek. I mean, he's all boy. And I mean, it's told in his perspective. So you would think it would be easily marketable to boys.
Yes,
but it has a heart sticker on it, and so they shy away from it. I mean, not only does it have a heart sticker if it's in the library, but I mean, it has a great big heart in,
on the
you know,
cover,
in the
right?
It's love, you know, it's love and other unknown variables. Yeah. So they shy away. But the brave boys, young men who have read it, by and far have really enjoyed it and have spoken out to me like, thank you, I connected with this guy. He was realistic. He was like me. He wasn't like all these other romance guys, and have really, really connected with him and with the story and enjoyed it. And, which has been wonderful, but you're right. It's very hard to market to boys when you have, a big red heart, even
yeah.
if there's mathematical symbols running through the heart,
right.
still not easy to do, but it is what it is.
The good librarians in the world have got things like that figured out in a way that they can
yes.
they can make the list of if you like this, read this, and lead them
mm-hmm.
you know the pathway
yes.
to the thing. So
yeah.
So
yeah,
thanks
and I'm
for
100%
that, because...
certain. Yes, exactly. And I'm certain all the boys who have had it placed in their hands, it was from a librarian or a well-versed bookseller who just really has an eye out for them and whatnot. I'm positive that's how they got a hold of that book, and I'm just so thankful for that. that they weren't afraid to push it on them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and the whole thing with boys, I tell you, I had the worst time with getting teen boys to read, because I had a lot of girls that were reluctant readers too. And but the boys, you know, they look at the size of the book. They look at the page count. You know, before they did anything else, they didn't even ask what it was about. You know, they look at it, flip it over, flip to the back page. Oh, it's got 300. I'm not reading that. You know, and it's like, oh, gosh, come on. You know, and it's funny because my husband actually used to do that too, till I got him reading books that he enjoyed, and then he doesn't care anymore. So, but, you know, it's just a matter of getting that book in hand of the right book in the right hand of the right person. And, and, you know, they've got to read it for whatever project. They're just like, I got to read a book. And then they go, wow, they come in, they come back to the library and said, oh, that was really good. You know, anything else like that? Don't tell anybody, you know, but you know, I want another.
Yes. Yeah. Do you have something else? What's next? Yeah. That's the best, you know, that's the best question. What's next?
Yeah. So, that's really great.
Yeah.
Now you have something to offer them.
Yes, exactly. There you go. So it's got something for both. But yeah, I have a girl at my, I have a daughter is my oldest, 13, and then my son is 11. And they're both very big readers, but it is amazing to see how differently they read. And they will read the same books, but they obviously come out of them with two completely different experiences.
Oh, absolutely.
So both from, you know, age and gender and experience and, you know, everything that they bring to it. So, and the types of books that they gravitate to. But my son is definitely, he does it less now, but he was always the one who looked at how many pages were in the book when we were at the library to pick out, you know, we go every 2 weeks and he'd go to pick them out. And you could see him just shy away from anything that looked too hefty. Until he and his father read Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings. And now that he's gotten through that, you know, he feels like he can get through anything in the world.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
That kind of broke him of the, oh, how many pages is it kind of mindset. Whereas my daughter,
that's awesome.
You can't get her to stop reading. So,
Yeah. There's good and bad with that, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, actually, last night she was had, we had just gotten our copies of the Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
Oh.
And she, it was like 10 o'clock, 10, a little after 10 o'clock, and she was, you could tell she was maybe 30, 40 pages from the end. And I knew, I mean, it was time for her to go to bed, but I knew there was absolutely no way that was going to happen. So, I was like, all right, you just stay up and read until you're done. I'm exhausted and going to bed here, but you read and don't be a grouch tomorrow.
Well, at least it came out of summer.
And then, yes, exactly. Yeah, she's got just a few more days till school starts. So I figured this is the only, you know, this is a one-time opportunity, my friend. Just stay up and read all night. I don't care. But don't be grouchy at me in the morning. So, oh, well,
that's awesome. I'd love to have that problem with my 14-year-old. She's not a reader. She reads manga. She loves manga, but yeah.
Oh yeah, my
reader.
Son likes that too. Yeah.
Her attention span's about as long as a gnat, so yeah. You know, it's pretty terrible for a librarian to have a kid that doesn't enjoy reading like I do. So.
I know.
Someday I'm gonna work on my 5-year-old for, you know, bringing him up with the right stuff. So anyway. But you've actually heard from young men who've read your book, from teen boys who've read it. Well, that's really awesome.
I have.
That they would even have the guts to write you is awesome.
They do. I know. They're so wonderful.
That's a neat thing. Yeah. And you know, that's like an extra bonus for, you know, writing a story just because you have a story to get out and you put your baby out into the world and you want people to like it, but then you get that extra bonus with the ones you didn't think it would ever touch really respond like that and get some feedback. That's a good feeling. So congrats on that. That's really cool.
Thank you. Yeah. It's been nice. I absolutely love hearing from readers. It's my favorite thing. And I mean, and social media makes that so easy for people to reach out. I even do it when I finish a book that I absolutely love. I'll tweet something out or at the author, just thank you for this, you know, story and whatnot. It makes it's it's so nice to have that now. I didn't have, you know, growing up, that wasn't,
oh yeah,
authors
yeah.
were these weird, straight, like distant, you know, almost like magical folk that, you know, lived uh-huh. up somewhere, you know. It didn't help too. I met Pat Conroy when I was a teenager, who wrote The Great Santini and The Prince of uh-huh. Tides.
Oh wow.
And he and he lived, he's a Southern, big Southern writer. I'm from North Carolina. And he told me about when he would get into, like, really deep into writing, he lived in this big old house and it had a turret. And so he would climb up into, his office was in the turret, and he would climb up there and he would lock himself in his room and he would write
wow.
for days and days with no breaks. And his wife and his daughter were there too. His young daughter, and they nodded, and the little girl was like, sometimes we bring him food, but he doesn't normally eat it. So I kind of, like, as a teenager, I thought, oh my gosh, this is how real writers work. They, you know, lock themselves in towers with typewriters
yes.
and, you know, don't emerge for weeks on end. And so growing up, that's really what I thought being an author was like. And then nowadays I realize that it's not at all what that is like, because my kids are constantly walking in. And I mean, most of Love and Other Unknown Variables was like, it was started while my son would be watching, like, the Spectacular Spider-Man on TV and I was writing in the corner, and then
yeah.
the rest of, like, yeah. And then it was finished, like, while, like, I was sitting at the pool while they were doing swim lessons, I was doing like, so I was never in a turret at any point in time in my writing
or a cabin
process.
In the woods, or yeah, nothing
right.
like
I don't
that.
Have the cabin in the woods. I don't have the retreat. I don't have any of that. Social media makes authors very real today, which I think is great, because I was afraid for the longest time to admit, even to myself, I want to be an author, because I thought mm-hmm. you need a turret and a typewriter and people to bring you food. But now I know that it's made up of very real people who you can chat with and, you know, and talk to through social media. And
yeah.
I love that for my kids too, because they're seeing that. And for my daughter is a beautiful writer, and is not afraid to say, oh no, I think I want to be, you know, I want to be a publisher and a writer, and I want
awesome.
All of these kinds of things that felt like dream jobs. Like, I might as well say I want to be Bon Jovi.
Yeah.
But you know,
right.
that's, can I be a member of KISS? I don't know. Like, that's what it felt like to say I want to be an author. But today it doesn't feel like that. And for that, I'm so, so grateful for all the ways that we can connect with readers and writers together and chat and, like, radio programs like this. So,
yes,
thank
exactly.
you.
Exactly. Yeah, social media has made the huge world, it's like it's so much bigger, but it's so much smaller, you know.
Yes.
It's so much bigger because you have so much more access, but it's so much smaller because you can get that access just about anywhere. You know, so it's really, I don't know, it's just been amazing watching it since, like, 2007 change in the last
mm-hmm.
eight or nine years. It's just been crazy and wonderful, and people can connect and really get to know. Yeah, I'm sure that some of your readers, you probably know pretty well because they're always commenting and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, wow, because if you walk into a place and they say, hey, I'm such and such, you know exactly who they are. So
yes.
That's
yeah.
neat.
Yeah, I do. I enjoy that very, very much. Oh, you're the one that tweeted the picture of the dog in the Santa suit. Yeah, so it makes for instant connections and wonderful things. So
yeah. So yeah, I have like 1,327 best friends all on Facebook.
There you go. It's an introvert's dream, really.
It really is. It really is. I agree. I agree with that 100%. So yeah, I talk to people I never would have talked to, because I just
yeah.
was, yeah, I wouldn't have picked up the phone and called somebody. So boom.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, so, back to writing.
Okay.
Here's our thesis. So you were an English teacher,
mm-hmm.
and obviously you were an avid reader growing up. I mean, you don't get to be an English teacher without being into literature. So,
right.
What were some of your, when you were, let's just say, preteen to teen, what were some of your favorite things to read?
Well, I was, let's see, I was a preteen in the 80s. And so there was a lot of Sweet Valley Twins.
Oh, yeah.
Sweet Valley High. Yeah. And I do remember that I devoured those. And there was the strange, the scary ones, Christopher Pike, all his strange,
oh, yeah,
odd books.
Oh,
remember
came
those?
Back, came out back then.
There,
yeah,
those,
I forgot.
They were nuts. So there were those. So I do know that I read those, and I feel like I devoured them. I had a job later, and my boss called it brain candy. And I feel like those were like kind of brain candy. You know, it tastes good going in, but it's going to rot your brain eventually.
Right.
But
at least you're reading.
Exactly, because there's nothing wrong, you know, with yeah, reading what you love. But I don't know that I loved them so much as uh-huh, they were what were available to me.
Right.
I do know that books like the Bridge to Terabithia, so Katherine Patterson's books, really all of hers, but Bridge to Terabithia and Where the Red Fern Grows, those were books, and that was even earlier than preteen. That was probably like fifth grade, 10, 11, that those were the books that kind of opened up this whole idea that words on a page, black and white print, could reduce me to tears,
yes,
and like make me have all these deep emotions that I then had to, I'm really good at repressing emotions and compartmentalizing. I always have been. Yeah. And so I think even as a kid, it was really great for me to read those things so that it would like drag everything out from inside and force me to really start looking at it all and digging through it, which is probably why I write the way I do now, that my books are hopefully digging things out for people and helping them to look through all the stuff they've got stuffed down inside of them and try to help them figure that stuff out. So I know those books were just pivotal for me. I mean, Where the Red Fern Grows, I mean, that was my first book hangover. I didn't know what to do with myself when I was done. I just lay on my bed sobbing, my twin bed sobbing about Big Dan and Little Ann for just days on end. And my mom wasn't a reader and my sister wasn't a reader. My dad was, but he never really talked, I guess, growing up in a house full of girls, and he was always reading like spy novels and whatnot. So he didn't really talk about the books he was reading. So my mom and my sister were just baffled by my behavior over a book. Like they couldn't wrap their brains around that. So that really sparked it for me. And then when I was a freshman, I read To Kill a Mockingbird. And there are a lot of To Kill a Mockingbird references and nuances and whatnot in Love and Other Unknown Variables. That book right there was a huge turning point for me. Just I wanted to be able to do what Harper Lee had done. I wanted to be able to tell that kind of a story that was meaningful and could just make people stop and think and cry and
right,
laugh too. Like her, that one, yes, makes me laugh too. I love when you can laugh and cry in the same, you know, almost beat. So that was,
yes,
that was a huge one for me. Was that one. Otherwise, I wandered around picking up the books that my dad and my grandmother left around. So I read like Stephen King and Dean Koontz and Tom Clancy was what my dad was leaving around, and they were terrifying. And then my grandmother, we would spend like a week in the summers up with my grandparents. Had two up in Cape Cod. One set was in Cape Cod and the other was on this tiny little island near Buffalo, New York, called Grand Island. And nothing on Grand Island to do but sit around and read. Anyway, so I would pick up Danielle Steele and Nora Roberts. So I was a young teenager reading like Stephen King and Tom Clancy and then Danielle Steele and Nora Roberts, and I couldn't decide like which was more terrifying, like the adult romance, or I had no, I apparently was destined to be a romance writer because I was reading Danielle Steele and Nora Roberts at 13. But yeah.
Well, at least you didn't mix the two and make it, you know, horror romance, because that would be really
horror romance with heaving bosom. I'm not sure how. I don't know. One day, a writer should have goals. So one day, maybe we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Let me know when you get there. We'll have a special talk about that one.
Yeah. Okay. We'll do a special show.
Oh, gosh. So you did you decide back then that, you know, you or did you try writing back then, or was this just something that, I mean, I think every English teacher, because I was a teacher for a while, but I think every English teacher is, you're telling people to write all the time.
Yeah.
You know. Exactly, even right. So you've got this, you're already halfway down the road.
Right.
So you might as well write something yourself.
Yeah.
But,
and I've always been a writer. I'm not very good at I'm very slow at processing the world around me, my emotions, just everything. It has to do too with that compartmentalizing and repressing. Mm-hmm. And writing has always been a way for me to put my world back in order.
Uh-huh.
So I've always kept journals. I actually don't keep journals anymore, but growing up, I always was writing in journals all the way through college and that kind of stuff. And I would start stories. I was very good at starting stories. And I would take them about, a little over a quarter of the way into the story. And then I hit a point where I was like, I don't know what happens next. And I'd panic and just, I'm going to be a failure, and I'm a perfectionist. So you can't or think you might fail. A lot of the times we'll walk away.
Right.
Because our brains can't make peace with something not being perfect, and a failure is anything but perfect. Or at least
right.
at the time, that's what I thought. I'm a recovering perfectionist, I guess I should say, because I'm doing much better with it now. So I would stop and quit and like run the other way. I instead was like, okay, well, I can't write stories, but I can teach the stories and I can teach how to write the stories. So that led me down the road for teaching English, definitely. And teaching writing was my favorite thing to do. And again, when I would tell my students, all right, it's time to write, let's all get down to work, we've got this much time, and I would sit and write with them, definitely.
Oh, okay.
But again, I was I'd force them to finish a story, but I never did, so it was a do what I say and not what I do at that moment in time. So I did that for years and years, and then and then when I was 30, I'd been staying home with my kids for a few years, and really kind of drifting in a loss. I love being a mom, and I'm still mom first and writer second. But I was a little, kind of drifting and not sure what I was doing with myself or with this big brain I have, and because folding the laundry and 7 times a day and scrubbing the toilets and whatnot is not doing the workout that I maybe needed. So that was happening. And then at the same time, I had my friend Emily Bright, who Love and Other Unknown Variables is dedicated to. When we were 23, she was actually 23 that she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. It was stage 4 when she was diagnosed. She did surgery and chemo and was at 23 and was in remission for about 5 years. And then around the time that I was turning 30, it was back again, because ovarian cancer likes to do that. It's got a very high return rate, basically. And so she had to go for chemo treatments again. And this time I was living in the same area as her. When we were 23, I was in Denver and she was in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So I couldn't be there for her. But the second time I was very close, and her chemo treatments were like 6 to 8 hours long for mm-hmm. each one. So I would go to the hospital. My mom and my aunt would come watch my kids, and I would go and sit with her at the hospital during these long chemos, kind of relieve her mom. And there were a bunch of friends that we would come and all hang out with her to keep her company during this time. And she's was an amazing, amazing person, and always very hopeful. Always kept thinking, you know, I just need to hang in here long enough until there's a cure. That was kind of her mm-hmm. goal there. And she's like, no, I'll make it. I can hang till that happens. And very brave and so much grace that she dealt with this with, and humor too. She would just make jokes that make everyone, including the nurses there, laugh. So anyway, it was during this time watching her be so, so brave that I realized that my fear of failure was absolutely ridiculous because I was fearing failing at writing a story when she was unfearful at failing in like chemo treatments,
right.
You know, like the idea of failure at beating this cancer was something that she wasn't flinching at. And I felt like I needed to do better. So it was at that time that I decided I'm going to write a novel. I'm actually going to get past the icky part that I usually stop at and keep going. And so I did. I said it was a New Year's Eve when I started, and it took 9 months to get through a novel length story, and it was the worst story ever. and it has never seen the light of day, and the computer that it was on has crashed, and there is no record of the story, and that's good. But immediately after finishing that story, the point was to finish, you know, was to start and finish,
right.
And then it didn't have to be good. And immediately after that, I was able to start Love and Other Unknown Variables. Totally because of my friend M and the lessons that she taught me on being amazing and brave and not being so afraid to fail. So
that's awesome.
That's when I decided. I decided to be a writer when I was 30. I'm a late bloomer.
Oh, that's
always
okay.
Been a late. Yeah.
It's never too late to start. And that's a really inspirational story. You know, sometimes it takes something like that to really look inside yourself too. And that's like what you were saying earlier, that you'd like for your stories to give people that as well, where they kind of look inside
mm-hmm.
themselves a little bit and dig down a little bit. So you're just passing it on. You're passing on the gift that she gave you. So that's
I hope
cool.
so.
Yeah.
I
think that's
I hope
great.
To be able to share M with as many people as I can. It's an honor to get to do it.
And so you never looked back after that, or, you know, you just kept going?
Yeah, I mean, I kept going. The story, M actually passed away before the story was done, before Love and Other Unknown Variables was done. And I do remember afterwards a friend saying, you know, are you afraid of, once I started querying agents, literary agents and whatnot, I had a friend asking, are you afraid of failing? And at that point I was able to say no, because it's not an option really. It might take a really long time to find an agent. It might be a painful process. My path to publication might take me here, there, and everywhere, but I'm doing this, you know, at that point in time, I'm doing this for M, and no, I'm not going to fail. I can't, I'll make it work. So from then on, that's pretty much, I'm going to make this work kind of an attitude. Once I had an agent, and then Heather Howland at Entangled, fell in love with Charlie and Charlotte, bless her heart. And, and then it all just kind of snowballed from there, because I said I was an accidental romance writer, but I was actually also an accidental series writer.
Right.
because I had written Love and Other Unknown Variables. I'm very accidental. I just stumble around in life, apparently. But I had written Love and Other Unknown Variables as a standalone novel. And when I the very first phone conversation I had with Heather Howland at Entangled, and she said, well, did you ever think about writing another, a sequel to the story? And I laughed kind of maniacally in her ear. Because no, gosh, no. And I, they're spoiler free zone, but no, I had written a standalone novel and there was nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Or so I thought, because then she said, well, some of us around here were just wondering, what happens to Becca. And Becca Hansen is the main character in Love and Other Unknown Variables. She's his younger sister and she's best friends with his love interest in that story as well. So she was a secondary character, but she was the bookworm, and everybody loved her. Fans from the first book, that's the biggest one I get, is they love two people the most, and it's Becca, and then beyond Becca, it's Mrs. Dunwoody, who's this octogenarian neighbor of Charlie's,
right,
with a swearing problem. But as soon as Heather asked me, we wonder what happens to Becca, I couldn't stop thinking about it.
Oh, wow.
We got off the phone, and I just, for the next 2 weeks, that's all I could think about was what would happen to a girl like Becca, a very introverted, very shy bookworm who prefers the company of fictional characters to real people. What kind of position did I leave her in at the end of Love and Other Unknown Variables, and where should she go from there? And that's how Life After Juliet actually got its start, was from that one question. I just couldn't stop, and that writing the story was the only way to make myself stop thinking about it. So I accidentally wrote a series. And then from doing that, as I'm writing Becca's, there are more ideas for taking other characters and doing more companions in this universe that they're just little ideas in my head right now. But I thought I had written a standalone novel, and apparently not.
Well,
I'm
sure that fans of the first one are probably very thrilled that there's a companion. Like you said, they immediately wondered what happened to Becca. And, I know from my reading experience that once they come out with companions, I love it. It's just like, oh, yeah, give me another character. I want to go down that road.
Yeah.
Stay here where I was happy. Help my little book hanging over here.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And Becca was a great character. Well, actually, in the end, she has been a great character because so many of us can see ourselves in her. That's probably the biggest thing I hear from readers is I could really connect with her. I know exactly how she was feeling, of course, people reading books are bookworms generally. So they just really connect with her, whereas Charlie was a harder character to connect with because he'd never finished a novel voluntarily in his life. So he's a whole different weird species to us reader type folks. Becca has ended up being a great character, but when I first started writing it, I was horrified that I had said I would do it because all she wanted to do was sit in her room and read, which is great, but it does not make for an interesting plot.
Right.
Page, chapter after chapter of her thumbing through books was not exciting. So very early in the process, I was like, oh gosh, what am I going to do? I got to get her out of her bedroom and get some new people in her life. So it was an interesting process to write a companion. And midway through, I was like, I will never do this again. This is terrible. I don't know why I said I would do this. And now I'm like, oh, let's do it again. So funny.
You ride the roller coaster, and halfway through, you're like, "Oh my god, I should never have got on this." But at the end, you're like, "Wow, that was so much fun. Let's go get mine."
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you crest that first hill, and you're like, "This was a bad idea." And then, you get off at the end, and you're like, "Let's get back online."
Right.
Yeah. I do love roller coasters, actually. So.
Well, there you go. You're in the right profession.
I guess.
I'm going to put the phone number out in case anybody wants to call in and chat. I do have an offered copy of hard copy of Life After Juliet for anybody that wants to call in. The phone number is 347-633-9609 if you want to call and talk to Shannon. And we have about 18 minutes left, so we talked over the middle, but that's okay. Because talking is what I do.
Well, I just joined you in that.
That's
it's
okay.
My
That's
fault.
Why we're here.
We wandered past the halfway point.
That's okay. We've got a good sense of where you came from, as far as your upbringing with reading, and then how you got into the writing thing. Tell me a little bit about when you had the story idea and you finished it, and did you finish it and then go seek an agent, or were you seeking an agent actively while you were finishing it? Tell us about that process.
Let's see. Yeah, so I wrote a complete draft and revised it of Love and Other Unknown Variables. And at the time, it was actually called Charlie Hansen Finishes Last and How the Universe Cheats. And it was a very different book, actually. Charlotte Finch was a very minor character and was not a love interest. It definitely wouldn't have fallen into the romance category, I don't think, at all. It was funny. It was just very humorous, very light. It was very light. It was like Love and Other Unknown Variables light version. And I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. I was doing research. I was reading a lot. I was doing a lot of research about publishing and the next steps and what to do and whatnot, and had done some research on agents. And there was an agent that I really thought would be, you know, a long shot, but a great, which is just, what have I got to lose? So I queried this agent, and she requested a full, and she read the full of that version of the novel, and I got a very lovely rejection from her. Lovely, just the loveliest rejection. And it was honestly I very lovely, and saying, I love the voice, I love the humor, but the stakes aren't high enough. And I cried for a good, night or two. And then, but it kind of clicked what she said, and she was right.
Yeah.
Because I was purposely avoiding, it's a story about love and loss, and I was avoiding, or at the time it wasn't that at all. It was just this fluffy thing. But that was what I was meant to write. And I was avoiding the loss. I was avoiding the hard part of the story. So she was right, 100% right. And I immediately, too, it was kind of like as soon as I read it, I was like, she's right. And I know exactly what I have to do to fix it. And then a little bit of me was like, oh, God, I don't want to do that. That's terrible. I have to rewrite the whole thing.
Yeah.
There has to be another way. But there wasn't. So I basically I started basically from scratch. I think there's one scene that made it from that first into the final. I think it's only one short scene that lasted. Everything else had to get changed. Once I did that, once I had changed that, we had moved in the process of that and then whatnot. And I had found a writing group. I'm part of the YA Cannibals is what we call our group. And our motto is we eat our own. And we like to tear into each other's manuscripts and give very honest, very real, and very constructive feedback. And so I had joined that group and got a lot of feedback and just kept at it and kept at it until I felt like I had the best story I could get to at that point in time. And then in the meantime, while I would give it to them, it would, you know, take a few weeks for them to get back to me. And in that time, I would do my research on agents. So I had one of the few times in my life that I used a spreadsheet. I had a big, crazy, color-coded spreadsheet with all these agents' names and what they were looking for and how to query them and all that kind of stuff, and just kind of started going through in waves. Which is just a lovely process because you just get waves and waves of rejection. I think about the third wave, I started hitting on, some requests and things like that. But I had tiered the way that I was sending them out so that like my top picks were in the later waves, so that if it hurt as bad, you know, take it third. You're like, I didn't want you anyway. You were in my first wave, that kind of thing, just to boost yourself up. I highly suggest that because you're going to get a lot of rejection. So you might as well get some that you're like, I don't care about it anyway.
Right.
To make yourself feel good. Like I'm rejecting you when that's not at all the case. But anyway, so up in my top echelon of people, I ended up querying Jessica Sinsheimer at the Sarah Jane Freeman Literary Agency, and she loved it, and we had a phone call, and as soon as I talked to her on the phone, I knew she was the one. She was so kind and smart, whip smart, and the creativity like oozes out of this woman. So that was how I ended up with her, and then from there everything seemed to go pretty quickly. I mean, obviously there was plenty more rejection, but I had somebody else to suffer through that with, so it wasn't as bad.
Better when you have
a
partner.
She was like, we didn't really want them anyway, it's fine.
Right.
Me telling myself that. So,
that's funny.
Makes it better.
Funny.
Yeah, so it was a long process. The first book took 6 years from the moment when I thought about the beginning until it hit bookshelves. It was a long process. The second one, from the first moment that Heather asked what happens to Becca until bookshelf, is about 3 years. So I'm getting faster. Maybe.
You're getting better.
Maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
Well, you've got two kids too, so.
Yeah. Life
gotta
is
gotta do mommy
thing. I like to just, you know, appease myself with, well, you're you're writing for quality, not quantity. So that's just what I have to tell myself because I'm very slow.
But, well, and there's plenty of people who put, you know, a year and, they're not worth the money you pay for them sometimes. So I agree with that 100%.
I'm just slow. Yeah. It's just what I tell myself. Some people can crank out amazing work, like numerous works in a year. I don't know how they do that.
They don't have my son.
I'm just slow. It's because I wander.
Yeah.
I get lost so often. It takes me a while to get back on track.
So you're just thinking up all the great backstory that goes along with it. So that's it.
It is fun. It is fun. My way is fun. I will say that much. Very fun.
Well, we're getting down to about 10 minutes, but I want to make sure that everybody, first of all, I'd like to know what you've got planned now that you've got Life After Juliet out on the shelves and it's doing well. Then what have you got planned past that one?
I am currently working on a brand new story set in a brand new town with all new people. Which has been fun. There are no expectations for it. So I'm taking my sweet time. However, it is about to, I think I have to submit it to the cannibals. I think my month is coming up soon. I don't remember. It's real soon that it's about to get cannibalized. And then the hard work really, I guess, sets in, is putting it back together again.
Right.
But I'm very excited about it. It's very different. It's darker somehow. Hopefully still funny. Since it's so new and weird and squishy, there's not a whole lot. It is set in the mountains in North Carolina. So it is contemporary, but it's kind of contemporary that kind of like nudges and kisses that kind of paranormal ghost story kind of line. Because the mountains there are so full of so many stories and legends that kind of, I feel like they cross over, you know, if you're not careful, you can cross that line, or those stories can cross that line into your everyday life too. It's contemporary, but I'm butting it right up against that line there, trying to pull in as much of that like mountain mystique as I possibly can. So, which
sounds really interesting.
It's my favorite place on earth to be in those mountains. So I'm really excited to have a story set there.
That sounds really neat. I love things that are attached to folklore like that. So it's neat.
Yeah, it's been fun. It's been fun to work on and to take a break and do something. Both Love and Other Unknown Variables and Life After Juliet were very therapeutic for me writing them, dealing with the loss of my friend and grief and moving on in our life and seizing your own life and that kind of thing. So they were amazing and I needed to do them, but now it's nice to kind of step away from that and move into some new ground.
That's neat. And tell us, all your books are available at all the major retailers, websites, in the stores. It's actually in hardback right now. Is it available in paperback as well, or not? They haven't done that yet. I know that
Entanglement always
starts with the hardback, which I always loved as a librarian, by the way. So if you're ever planning on changing that Entangled, don't, because they don't want paperbacks in the library. They want hardbacks.
No, they don't want paperbacks.
And I know a lot of their adult lines, they don't do hardbacks. They just go straight to paperback.
Right.
So that's really awesome that they still do that, because I think you think about, especially in the teen department, they want hardbacks so these books don't fall apart before they get read.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Yeah, and as an author too, it's always super exciting to see the hardback too, and hug it and all that stuff. Yeah. So they're both in hardback, and they can be found all around. And if they are in some independent booksellers as well. If your local indie bookstore doesn't have it, please recommend that they check it out and carry it. I love indie bookstores, and would love to have my books in as many of them as possible too. So I can travel all around the country and find them. It's a good
That's right.
To go visit fun bookstores. I'll call it work.
There are a ton of really great ones too. So yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
And then you have an Amazon author page. You can follow you there. You have a Facebook author page. You have Twitter and an Instagram. Mm-hmm. And what is your website?
It is www.shannonleealexander.com.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That kind of sums that up.
That one's pretty easy. Social media, I'm on all of them. I'm probably most active on Instagram right now. I feel like it goes in cycles. I'll be on Twitter a whole lot, and then I'm like, I'm done with that. Now here's Instagram. Facebook is probably the least, where I'm least active, but I'm all around. You can find me anywhere. So you can email me, Shannon@ShannonLeeAlexander.com. I love emails. I'll email you back, I promise.
Very cool.
I'm good at getting back to people.
Well, thanks so much for being on tonight. Like I said, it was a real pleasure, and I was very excited to get to be able to talk to you. I wish you much luck. And when you get this new project done, I want to hear about it. So when you get it ready to publish and stuff, let's talk again, and we'll see about getting you on the show, because I love that folklore stuff. It's just so much cool.
Thank you. Anyway. Yeah, definitely. And when I do my horror romance too, right?
Oh, yes, that one, for sure.
Oh,
yeah, we'll get
that
you,
one too.
We'll get definitely. You on the horror show, and I'll get on there as a guest host, and we'll talk about both sides of it.
There you go, when I do the horror romance too. But first, we'll do the folklore one. Okay.
There you go.
I got
there
it.
You go. Well, best of luck, and enjoy your last few days of summer. I'm sure you're going to enjoy the kids back to school, because I know I am.
And I'll be able to get, like, really get into writing again, so I can get you this folklore book. I gotta get them back in school so I can focus. So,
there you go.
Yeah. Well, and thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun, and you're just a delight to talk to. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I told you it would go by fast, and you wouldn't even forget
it. It did.
Yeah.
It blew right by.
Well, thanks a lot, and we'll be in touch for sure. Definitely.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
And you can find me on Facebook at the Librarian on Authors on the Air. I'm on Twitter at HOT_librarian, and Google+ is Tabitha Pope, but I'm rarely on Google+, so don't even look for me there. I'm on Instagram as well as Tabitha Pope_librarian, I think. So you can find me there. This podcast has been recorded and will be available as a podcast from the Authors on the Air website, SoundCloud, and iTunes right after this recording, or right after this show ends, about 5 minutes later. It's available at the same link as a recording. Authors on the Air Global Radio Network can be found online at Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and about anywhere else you can think of in the social media universe. And thanks again for Entangled for bringing on great authors on my show, and for Authors on the Air Global Radio Network for letting me share my passion for romance and the hottest authors in young adult, new adult, and adult romance with all of you. I will see you guys next Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern right here on The Librarian. Until then, have sweet dreams.